Well, Seymour, I made it, despite your directions.
Ah, Superintendent Chalmers, welcome. I hope you're prepared for an unforgettable luncheon.
Yeah.
Oh, ye gods! My roast is ruined! But what if I were to purchase fast food and disguise it as my own cooking? Ho, 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 ho. Delightfully devilish, Seymour.
Crazy explanations. The superintendent's gonna need his medication. When he hears Skinner's lame exaggerations, there'll be trouble in town tonight.
Seymour! Superintendent, I was just stretching my calves on the windowsill. Isometric exercise. Care to join me?
Why is there smoke coming out of your oven, Seymour?
That isn't smoke. It's steam. Steam from the steamed clams we're having. Steamed clams. Superintendent, I hope you're ready for mouth-watering hamburgers.
I thought we were having steamed clams.
No, I said steamed hams. That's what I call hamburgers.
You call hamburgers steamed hams?
Yes, it's a regional dialect.
What region?
Upstate New York.
Really? Well, I'm from Utica, and I've never heard anyone use the phrase steamed hams.
Oh, not in Utica, no, it's an Albany expression.
I see. You know, these hamburgers are quite similar to the ones they have at Krusty Burger.
Oh, no. Patented Skinner Burgers. Old family recipe.
For steamed hams.
Yes.
Yes, and you call them steamed hams despite the fact they are obviously grilled.
You know, one thing I should... Excuse me for one second.
Of course.
Oh, well, that was wonderful. Good time was had by all. I'm pooped.
Yes, I should be. Good Lord, what is happening in there?
Aurora Borealis?
Aurora Borealis. At this time of year, at this time of day, in this part of the country, localized entirely within your kitchen.
Yes.
May I see it?
No.
Seymour, the house is on fire!
No, Mother, it's just the northern lights.
Well, Seymour, you are an odd fellow, but I must say, you steam a good ham.
Help! Help!
Ladies and gentlemen, now it's Too Late with Alan Moser.
Yeah.
Whee!
Aurora Borealis. Guys, welcome back to another episode of It's Too Late. I am your host, Alan Moser, joined as always by the number one producer in late night. It's Dave Wilimowski. Dave, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good. So excited to be here again. Starting to get all packed up for the big trip, the big event.
Oh,
pretty excited about that.
You must be talking about the 6th annual It's Too Late live show coming to you Saturday, May 18th here in beautiful Columbia, Tennessee. I mean, I would say you should get your tickets, but I'm just exhausted from even. At this point, you're either coming if you're not, and if you are coming and you haven't got tickets, just find me at the and just give me $50. Just show up and say hey, like you'll see me in the corner, the guy who's like looking at the poncho's bill and like wiping the sweat from his brow. Just give that guy some money. He's deserved it.
Help him out.
Yeah. Starting off tonight's news, there will be no lovemaking in the City of Love as anti-sex beds have arrived in Paris, France for the 2024 Olympic Games, a movement to deter the participating athletes from engaging in promiscuous sex and orgies.
Wow.
That's right. They're giving them twin-size beds that are all made with 100% recyclable lightweight cardboard in order to make intercourse more difficult.
Wow.
You know, with these changes, the athletes have now joined watchers around the world in not caring at all about the Olympics. I don't care.
You know? I don't like it.
No, you don't. Don't lie to me. Yeah, you're taking off work that week to watch the Olympics. Yeah, don't lie to me. In celebrity news, Jeff Goldblum made headlines this week when the actor announced that he would not be leaving an inheritance to his two sons, 8-year-old Charlie and 6-year-old River, saying that the two kids would have to provide for themselves. And he said, and I quote, "You've got to row your own boat." You know, if it isn't bad enough that he named one of his kids River, then he told him he has to learn to row his own boat. Yeah. And of course, as you may recall, last week here on the show, we celebrated National Teacher Appreciation Week. Hey, move over, overrepresented rapists, because now it's time, that's right, for National Police Week. That's right, folk. So this week, you know, instead of saying 40% of cops beat their wives, maybe try instead saying 60% of cops don't beat their wives. Hey, good for them. Let's get those numbers up a little bit, though. You know, cops often get accused of being racist, but how can that be true when their wives' eyes are black? Also, in world news tonight, the United Nations reports that more UN aid workers have died in Gaza as a result of strikes by the Israeli Defense Forces. Check out this tweet right here from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who said, quote, "Today, a UN vehicle was struck in Gaza, killing one of our colleagues and injuring another. More than 190 UN staff have been killed in Gaza. Humanitarian workers must be protected. I condemn all attacks on UN personnel and reiterate my urgent appeal for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire and the release of all hostages." Actually, you know, tonight we have a clip of the UN's direct appeal to Israel and the response from Tel Aviv. Take a look. He didn't say the magic word. Yeah. The killings will continue. You know what? Speaking of Israel, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, that's AIPAC, the infamous pro-Israel lobbying group, has spent $300,000, $300,000, Dave, to run commercials targeting Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie. Here, take a look at the commercial.
Israel, the Holy Land, under attack by Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Congressman Tom Massie. Republicans are trying to help Israel.
What?
One Republican is standing in the way. It's Kentucky's Tom Massie. 15 times in April, Massie was the only Republican voting with anti-Israel radicals. Massie's votes, helpful for Iran, harmful to Israel. Everyone who cares about the Holy Land needs to know Tom Massie is hostile to Israel.
United Democracy Project is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Wait, I'm sorry, hold on. let me read that line again. Israel is under attack by Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Congressman Tom Massie. They make it sound like he's over there laying siege.
It's pretty...
Yeah, 15 times in April alone, they tried to give your hard-earned tax dollars to Israel, with Massie being the lone Republican no vote. What a ringing endorsement for Thomas Massie. Hey!
Yeah,
good for him. That's right. Boy, speaking of a ringing endorsement, let me tell you about tonight's sponsor, which is Fox & Sons Coffee, which you can find at foxandsons.com. Oh, Steve's going to be there.
Yeah, I need to get some more coffee. That'll be perfect.
You'll be able to get coffee this weekend from Steve Fox.
Right out of his hands.
Right out of his hands. Awesome. Well, yeah, preferably peacefully. Like, you, money's in one hand and coffee. Yeah. Anyway, fans of It's Too Late, use code ITL. Get 18% off orders of $25. Does that mean you walk up to Steve and you just say ITL?
Oh, do you still get the...
You just look at Steve's ITL.
Ooh, you wink like it's secret.
Well, it's definitely a secret you and Steve have. But anyway, I've got a bag of the coffee right here. This is the Din Blend 2 Electric Boogaloo. Can you get a shot of that right there?
Yeah.
Wait, hold on.
Get it. Yeah. There it is.
Anyway, that's Fox & Sons Coffee. over at foxandsons.com. Use promo code ITL. Guys, we're going to be back with the meme of the week and the viewer mail right after this commercial break. Don't go away. Back to the show, everybody. Hey Dave.
Yes, Alan.
What time is it?
Time for meme of the week.
When I see my dangerous extremist friends in real life. Oh, there's gonna be a lot of that going on here in a few days.
Yeah.
It's a definitely precursor to the 16 Annual It's Too Late Live Show. But we do have a bonus meme. Check out the bonus meme. Oh, this is also a precursor to this weekend for people traveling. Your cleaning fee is $200 says Airbnb. Okay, but if you're charging for a cleaning fee, then I'm not going to clean.
Oh, they hate that.
Yeah. But, I mean, where's the lie, though, right? Like, if they're already charging you the cleaning fee built into your rate, then why would you clean?
No.
Yeah.
Just walk out.
Yeah. Just leave. Yeah. They should be lucky you're not just staying. The stuff I've been hearing. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Let's go ahead and answer some viewer mail. Celeste Annis writes, "Dear Alan and Dave, what animal are you most looking forward to seeing at the event?" Yeah, we're going to a petting zoo. There's going to be some animals.
There, oddly enough, we are.
Yeah, so I think the baby kangaroo. And the little, you know, the little swaddling clothes, you got a little baby kangaroo. But, you got to do that now as opposed to a few years from now when it's 6 feet tall and it just beats you to death.
Yeah. You're picking that up.
Yeah. What about you, Dave? Which animal are you excited for?
Oh, I'm going to pet that llama.
Oh, you're going to get him?
I'm gonna give him a pet.
That is true. I told Blake that our VIP ticket holders get to get in the pen with the llama and see who's faster. So you better stretch your calves. That's all I'm saying.
I want to pull a hammy.
Okay. All right. Andrew Avery writes, "Dear Alan and Dave, can Palominos hit the high notes even when they're a little hoarse?"
Oh.
Andrew, the audience didn't laugh, so I don't know. Oh. I guess they didn't think it was very funny. That's a shame.
Yeah, no, it's too late.
Yeah, he said it. You said it. You said it's too late. Oh my god. We got it. Why don't we have a button for that yet?
Like a scream button. Like
Pee-wee's Playhouse. Okay. Let's see. Ryan Seifert writes, "Dear Alan and Dave, how many guns are allowed in my carry-on bag for my flight?" Let's see what else is inside. It's another gun. That's Ryan here in a few days. Anyway, y'all are gonna have to pick Ryan up from federal penitentiary. They don't like that. Eric Eli writes, "Dear Alan and Dave, what is your favorite item on the Long John Silver's menu?"
Oh.
You know, he said that because on this week's viewer mail post we had Long John Silver's on there. So well, I think a better question is, what's the last time that you ate at a Long John Silver's?
I was actually there once because I'd never had a fish taco before. So I went there and I bought a fish taco. Yeah. It wasn't bad.
I can literally hear the clacking from all the angry viewers writing in. Oh, you wanted to try a fish taco and you went to Long John Silver's.
What is that? Not a traditional fish taco?
All right. Well, anyway, guys, you direct your viewer mail to Dave on that one, not me. Josh Wright writes, "Dear Alan and Dave, if you were a ghost, where would you want to haunt?" Oh, probably Elm Springs at the Confederate Museum. What do you think?
Oh, that would be fun.
Yeah, we're going there on Friday.
Yeah.
We're taking the gang to the Confederate Museum, and it is haunted, and you guys will get to, you know.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Take some pictures.
Yeah, well, they don't. It's offensive to them if you go, ooh, so don't do that.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That's their word. So just putting that out there.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
All right. Aaron Kintner writes, Dear Alan and Dave, how many pit stops are acceptable on a 10-hour road trip? Well, Aaron, I think it depends a lot on whether you're like you by yourself or you are like in your case, you're going to have a car full of people like in the kids and everything. Family. So that's you're going to probably take more than one or two, I'd imagine.
Yeah, oh, I'd rather not, but yeah.
Yeah. How many do you think you're going to wind up with?
I'm going to.
What's the over under? Yeah.
I'm going to say five.
Five. Okay. So over yeah, five is a bad five. Trip. Under five is a good trip.
Is, I guess, acceptable. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see how acceptable your trip was here in a couple of days. Let's see. Keith, we already talked about the Northern Lights. We're done with that. Gary Deister writes, Dear Alan and Dave, what is the greater threat to human race, artificial intelligence, or people believe their vote actually matters? Well, I, you know, the people who think their vote matters have been around for a long time, and we're still kicking. Human race still exists. Now, AI, on the other hand, I've seen some Terminator movies.
Yeah.
And I think we're heading in the wrong direction. Yeah. So I'm going to say AI. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, up to a few years ago, I would have said the voter, but AI, they got the fingers right now, and that happened real fast. So who knows what's going to be the next couple years.
Yeah. And finally this evening, Mary Lynn Willimowski writes, Dear Alan and Dave.
Uh-oh.
What were some of the music albums you owned as a kid? Dave, what's a music album you owned as a kid?
I think the first one I got was DC Talk because my dad bought my boombox and he wanted me to listen to some good Christian rock, I guess. So he gave me DC Talk. And I think the first one I bought was Check Your Head by the Beastie Boys. Pretty much stayed in that kind of area.
Yeah. I had like Eagles' Greatest Hits and Lenny Kravitz' Greatest Hits and Queen Greatest Hits. And John Mayer Room for Squares. And those four were on rotate like my junior and senior year of high school.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it's fairly rounded kind of music.
Yeah.
You know, like there's no like rap or death metal in there, but.
No. Who needs that?
Yeah. Who needs that? Anyway, guys, we're going to be back with tonight's guest, Brian Kaplan, to talk about Build Baby Build. The science and ethics of housing deregulation right after this commercial break. Your ad could be playing right now, reaching thousands of potential customers. Sadly, it's not, but it could be. Find out how to be an advertised sponsor for It's Too Late with Alan Mosley. Email us at info@alanmosley.tv. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Our guest this evening is an economics professor at George Mason University, a New York Times bestseller, author of several books, including The Myth of the Rational Voter, Open Borders, and my personal favorite, The Case Against Education. His latest book I have right here, which is Build Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation, which is available now. Dr. Kaplan, be happy. Most of the schlubs that are on the show, I don't actually go out and buy their book, but I did buy your book. So, Dr. Kaplan, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, and I appreciate the actual purchase of a book. Very nice.
Well, you know, it's beautiful because with the graphic novel, with all the beautiful pictures and in the comic strips, that's easier for smooth brain people like me to understand. But before we get into the book, because there's going to be plenty of time for that, I follow you on social media, and I got to ask you, I'm worried about you. What is all? I keep on hearing about putting tenure to good use. Are you getting yourself into trouble, Brian?
Well, so far, so good. I am taking chances I wouldn't take if I didn't have tenure. The main thing is that my university, George Mason University, has decided to impose a mandatory two-course brainwashing requirement on the whole freshman body. And I went and publicly criticized this, and it wound up actually getting quite a bit of attention. In particular, our oversight board, the Board of Visitors, noticed it, and then they started asking questions, the people that are trying to do this to our students. Upshot is that I've managed to delay the requirement by 1 year. As to whether I'm really the crucial actor or not, I'm not sure. I think I am, actually. I think I did, just by doing a tweet and public comment. Basically, what happened is it was already a done deal, and then the people who were behind this had the poor sense to have one last public comments phase, and then I put in a public comment saying that this is a mandatory brainwashing requirement, and then I put it on Twitter. And then actually there was a George Mason student that reported me to our DEI office.
Oh, wonderful.
And then I went and said, hey, I'm getting reported to our DEI office. To be fair, the student said, I am not filing an official harassment complaint at this time. All right, good. Thanks. And also our DEI office didn't make any comment.
Well, that's the thing about
still,
harassment.
I do have a bet with someone, and this person, the bet is, will I be treated very unfairly by my university and my own judgment in the next few years? And I'm betting no, and the other guy is betting yes, and he's letting me adjudicate whether I've won the bet or not. But so far, so good.
Well, I know that you have a history of doing that. You do these bets, and my understanding is, I imagine you don't have a lot of people take you up on the bets because you're only betting on things that you feel pretty confident about.
Yeah, that's true. A couple times I've done bets where someone said they were really confident, and I said, fine, give me odds. Normally no one will give you odds, but I have gotten odds on a few things. And the very fact I really want to negotiate for odds is a sign maybe I'm not so confident.
Well, speaking of being a trailblazer such as you are, of course, Build Baby Build, which I showed everybody at the front, the science and ethics of housing regulation, it's done in the art style of the sort of graphic novel, which has been excellently done, by the way.
Thank you very much.
And which is the second one. So Open Borders, which I believe was also a pretty big hit, was done similarly.
New York Times bestseller.
Well, there you go. Absolutely. So what do you think? Do you think that this sort of vehicle for information has staying power? Have you seen anybody else kind of picking up the torch and saying, I think I want to create one of my own? How's that coming along?
I don't know anyone else in economics who's picking up the torch from me. There's a couple of other economists that have done it. I think they could have done a better job, honestly. I think we're beating the competition a lot in not just the quality of the art, but also the integration of the art with the point of the book. If you look at other people's graphic novels in economics, I'd say they're just not as good. Everybody can improve. But anyway, I'm a huge fan of the genre, and I'm a big believer in just gorgeous classic beauty. We draw a lot of artistic inspiration from classic Disney, Snow White, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, and I think it really does show. The artist is actually Adi Bronze. I do the storyboard, so I am actually involved in the art side, and I'm a very hard taskmaster. I tell the artist exactly what to do down to the smallest details, but I don't, in fact, do the arts. That's up to Adi, and it looks great, I think.
Well, getting into the meat of the book, there's a line, by the way, that you have in the book that I feel like encapsulates Dr. Brian Kaplan. I'm going to read this out. You said, I don't bother writing books for causes that are already winning. I write books for causes that deserve to win, which kind of leads us sort of to the open question of, if housing deregulation is such a good idea, why isn't it already winning?
Yeah, great question. Here is a pretty simple story. Housing regulation exists because people think the world would be a lot worse without it. I don't think that sheer self-interest is that important. It's true that homeowners usually oppose housing deregulation, but so do renters. It's basically humans tend to just think bad stuff is going to happen and don't see what the good is. Why is it that people are so determined to keep this regulation? I'd say, first of all, there is a very high degree of economic illiteracy. Most people just disagree that making more housing will reduce prices. This thing is so well established, such common sense. It's at the level of, come on, if you're running a lemonade stand and you can't sell your lemonade, what do you do to sell the lemonade? It's like, cut the price of the lemonade. Now, similarly, if you build a lot more houses, how are you going to go and fill your units? How are you going to sell the development? You're going to have to go and cut the price. And if a lot of people build a lot, the price is going to go down by a lot. But it's still true that most people surveyed in the U.S. just say, no, that's not how it works. Why they would think this? I think that most people's model that they have in mind is something like, oh, you think that if we're nice to developers and do them a favor and give them approval to build stuff, that they'll reciprocate by lowering their prices. But I think they're greedy jerks and won't do that. And my response is that's not what any economist thinks is going on. What economists think is that if you allow people to build more stuff, they will, in their own interest, cut prices because otherwise they won't be able to go and make the sales. That's the normal thing in business. You don't cut prices to be nice. You cut prices to actually close the deal. And that's what's going on with housing. Other reasons why people are so opposed to housing deregulation or so supportive of housing regulation. Another big one is just total innumeracy. You go and say, hey, we'll get trillions of dollars of gains. And they'll say, yeah, but there's a bird nest. And like, all right, well, what's the value of the bird nest exactly? Is it like a $1 billion bird nest? What's going on? Do you really think one bird nest is worth that much? It's very normal when you're arguing about this to say, oh, fine, there'll be a lot of gains, but there's a bunch of problems and the problems are all real small. And if you just put numbers on it, then you'd see that. But in a debate, usually it's not about numbers. It's about, have you got some really vivid stories that take over people's minds and like, oh my God, those poor birds or whatever. So I think that's a big deal. Status quo bias and just total paranoia, just assuming the worst. I mean, one key thing to understand about development is that, yes, there's a bunch of unpleasant things about living around other people. When you live around other people, there's traffic problems, parking problems, there's noise, blah, blah, blah. But there's also a whole bunch of good things about living around other people, like your kids can have some friends, or there's going to be enough customers for restaurants, that kind of thing. And what I say in the book, and I think this is pretty clear when you think about it, is that everyone who complains about how bad it is to live around other people has an actual effective remedy, which is just to move to the middle of nowhere. But almost nobody wants to do that. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they? I think actions speak louder than words. This shows that almost everybody prefers the package of the good things that people do plus the bad things they do to just having no benefits or costs of having people around. So I think that people, when they think about regulation, they only focus on possible bad things. They don't focus on offsetting good things, even though we know from firsthand experience the good normally outweighs the bad.
Well, it's funny enough, as I was listening to you just now, and also as I was reading the book, there were parts of the book that I thought of myself, you know, it can't be a coincidence that the guy that wrote this book also wrote the book, The Myth of the Rational Voter, because there's flavors of that logic in there. And then sure enough, of course, I turn the page and you do cite yourself. Yeah. In that, but I want to pose
cite yourself. Who will, man?
Well, exactly. well, doubly true for me. But I want to pitch to you a particular example that's very close to home. And you might, I actually put this in my email to you. So I live in Maury County, a couple of counties south of Davidson, where Nashville, Tennessee is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Columbia is not quite the smallest of small towns as it once was, but it's comparatively to a major city like Nashville, it's very small. The median income in Maury County is still only $37,000. Household is like $60,000. Mm-hmm. And yet, in all the new developments, because there is an abundance of land here, and all the new developments, they're all, as they're politely called, McMansions. It's, mm-hmm. you know, houses in the 300s, houses in the 400s, houses mm-hmm. in the houses in the 500s. And of course, we know that, well, logically, the median income Maury County and can't possibly afford to live in those houses. So what's going on there?
So probably, first of all, is that there's a lot of possible homeowners that are fleeing from worse regulation up in the area of Nashville. So they're going to go to an area with less regulation. They got a lot of money to spend. They want to have a nice place. I think it's also quite likely, actually, that there are some regulations right in your own town that are making it more profitable to go and build a smaller number of larger homes. Again, I don't know the exact regulations in your town, but almost everywhere has a minimum lot size saying that you need to use at least a certain amount of land for every house. And if you tell people that, tell builders you have to put an acre of land for every house, then yeah, it's like, well, if it's an acre of land, that's a lot of expensive land. I'm going to go and only put a big house here and try to draw some richer people here. If you can go and put a larger number of homes per acre, then you're generally going to be going and putting smaller homes, which in turn means that they're going to be lower prices. I thought you were going to ask, what does this do for the people that are already here? And the important thing to remember is that anytime you're increasing the supply of housing, you are actually going and making other homes that already exist more affordable just by the competition.
Sure. Well, I'm recalling Jeff Deist, who used to be the president of the Mises Institute. He had tweeted out very recently. It was right around the same time that your book came out. And it was just a very simple one light tweet that just said, America needs a million new starter homes. You know, the $100,000, $150,000 homes so that young couples who are marrying, starting families can get out of renting and get into homes. But you know, as per my example, you know, they're not putting up subdivisions of $100,000 homes. They're putting up subdivision of $500,000 homes where people are not making that kind of money. So would you say then, without digging into the minutia of every single individual community, that more like than not, there are firms that would be more than happy to develop mm-hmm. those subdivisions, and they can't because the city or state won't allow it?
Yeah, I mean, like, of course, it does depend upon the exact area you're in. I don't think the Beverly Hills is going to have $150,000 homes, but there are a lot of ways technologically to go and make homes much more cheaply. And as we know from just going through a Walmart, there are always businesses happy to go and make cheap stuff. There are products for every budget. It's just a question of the regulations do the regulations allow it to be profitable? Especially, of course, if you have already really strangled off housing supply, then you're going to start by going and selling to the customers that have the highest incomes. But even that, it's important to remember, all housing markets are connected. So it's not like building those homes that are luxury or not actually expanding housing affordability for people that would never live there. Always remember, when you build a mansion and a rich person moves in, well, where did the rich person used to live and who's going to live in their place? Well, it's probably going to be someone who isn't as rich as the rich person that's going to move in, and who's going to move into the house of that person, and who will move into the house of that person. The analogy that I use in the book is reverse musical chairs. The regular game musical chairs, you take chairs away. The game reverse musical chairs, you keep adding them. When you add more and more chairs, it's still likely that the fastest players are going to get the best chairs. But if you add enough chairs, then there's going to be seats for everybody. So yeah, if you can just let's go and add as many chairs as we can. Let's get government out of the way so that people can build stuff. Then, $150,000 does sound just lower than I think is believable for modern US, at least after all the inflation the last few years. But what I do say in the book is that it's totally reasonable that the average US housing price would fall by 50% if you really did serious deregulation.
Well, there's so many examples in your book that I it's one of those things where when you see it, you can't unsee it. Not even a quarter mile from where I sit at this desk right now, there is in fact a relatively new development. But someone has put a political ad on a billboard right at this development that says no more development on this road. I think it's Tom Osborne Road. Mm-hmm. Our community can't handle it, which makes me think of the NIMBY. What is a NIMBY?
Well, it stands for not in my backyard. It's not something that anyone is likely to call themselves. It's a term of abuse, honestly, but it is someone saying, look, it's fine for this thing to exist, but I don't want anyone anywhere near me. And the implicit criticism is, well, if everybody says that, then it just won't happen. If everybody says there can't be a nuclear plant within 50 miles of me, then I guess we're not going to have nuclear power, because there's always somebody within 50 miles, whatever you want to do. This is contrasted with YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard, which a lot of people do own as their favorite label. And it's basically the reverse idea of, it's totally fine and I'm supportive of this. There's a bit of an ambiguity. Are you supportive of it as an act of philanthropy where I'm going to just try to be a really decent guy and not complain when people build more stuff? Or is it actually based upon an optimism of it's actually better for me if we build more stuff on balance, because the good things of having neighbors outweighs the bad? Right next to me, there's actually was a major new development, and so far it's been pretty much just pain for me. But I was telling people all along, if my kids can just make one walkable friend in this new development, all the noise and traffic problems will have been totally worth it. To be fair, actually, I have had one big gain, which is I've got a much bigger area to take walks on. I do a lot of walks, so I've gotten that out of them. So I think actually it has been a net gain for me. But if my kids could make some friends there, then it would be hands down awesome, no question.
Well, one more question before we take our next commercial break. So there is a section of the book that's dedicated to the, you know, negative byproducts. I can't help but hear Thomas Sowell in my ear saying there are no solutions. There's only trade-offs. Mm-hmm. Of course, you talk about a panacea in your book. I'm not sure Thomas Sowell would ever use that term when he's when he's talking about trade-offs. But I guess the question would be, you know, like for our friends right down the street that I just referenced, I think traffic is always the one that pops up first. Is that, well, you know, obviously, of course, I mean, who loves traffic, right? Everyone thinks that whatever level of traffic they currently have is already too much. And so the idea of an even single more car on the road is much too much. What say you to the traffic argument?
Yeah. So first of all, of course, many people will just freak out over almost no change. So there's that. But if there is a serious problem, there are serious problems. There is a fantastic solution that already exists, totally technologically possible. I bet your readers have seen these before, right? We now have the technology to go and charge people based upon not only whether they're driving, but the exact traffic conditions that are happening when they're doing so. It totally works. Right. This is something where it's not just we can reduce congestion by raising prices. We can end congestion by raising prices. We can end congestion for traffic and congestion for parking. The only real complaint is just it's not fair. Driving and parking should be totally free. And then my question is, well, which is less fair? The current world where you have to pay $500,000 or $1 million for a house, but traffic and but driving and parking are free? Or an alternate world where you have to pay some modest sum to park and drive, but housing is half its current price. See, it makes a lot more sense to focus on cutting the price of housing and then raising the prices of goods that are congested instead of doing what we're doing right now.
Well, on that note, guys, we're going to be back to talk a little bit more about Build Baby Build with Brian Kaplan right after this commercial break. Don't go away. It's Too Late is proudly sponsored by Fox & Sons Coffee. Fans of It's Too Late use code ITL to receive 18% off orders of $25 or more. Shipping's always free on orders over $37.99. Visit them online at foxandsons.com. That's foxandsons.com. Welcome back to the show, everybody. We are joined once again by our friend Brian Kaplan, author of Build Baby Build, The Science and Ethics of Housing Regulation. I did want to mention as a point on that last point, on page 33, there is a perfect example. As someone who did live in Florida for a few years, you have the traffic congestion on the left side and everyone's trying to get to the beach and it's bumper to bumper and everyone's angry and honking. And on the right side, you have that lovely billboard that says Sun Pass. And of course, there's only a handful of cars and it's 20 minutes to the beach, kids. And I can tell you, as someone who lived in the area, for all the folks who say, oh, well, I just disagree with the concept of toll roads. If I travel to Florida or if I move to Florida, there's no way they're going to charge me for that. You are lying. I lived in Florida for a few years, and I will admit, as someone from a podunk southern town, I thought, well, I don't want to pay a buck or two here and there to take a toll road. Tell you what, after you've been on I-4 a few times, you realize, actually, I will in fact pay for a toll road, yeah. Because I'm actually saving money, right?
I mean, like so in our area, generally, we've got toll lanes right next to free lanes, and it always amazes me when you see $100,000 cars stuck in traffic in the free lane. Getting paid like $3 an hour in order to sit in traffic, which is one of the worst jobs known to man. Well, like, so you got $100,000 for your Mercedes, but you can't shell out for the toll. That's very odd priorities in my book.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that, Brian, because in my part of the world, in southern Middle Tennessee, you would be surprised how many people you will see driving six-figure, you know, Teslas or Maseratis or what have you up hills to their mansions out in the Tennessee hills, but they're driving up a muddy, unpaved driveway. So they bought the multi-million dollar home and the $100,000 car, but they won't pave their driveway. That's just that, you know, there's the rational voters for you right there. So all right, so just the term deregulation, because you talk a little bit about this in the book, is that, you know, that tends to be a scary term for some people, right? But I'm reminded of the phrase, you know, there's the stupid party and the evil party, and sometimes they get together to do something both stupid and evil, and it's bipartisanship. So politically speaking, would you say that this is one of these bipartisanship issues where even both on the left and right have sort of failed with the housing market?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Here's what I think is the best story. The actual conscious advocates of making it easier to build tend to be left-wing progressives in very regulated cities. So places like Manhattan or San Francisco, out of people call themselves YIMBYs with a Y, seems like to me probably three quarters are actually left-wing voting for Democrats. So on the one hand, the intellectual energy to go and deregulate is in the modern United States with the left. But if you want to go and see where in the U.S. do we have the best housing regulation, namely the least, and actually that's almost all in very Republican states. So you go to Texas or a place like that. What's interesting to me is having spent a lot of time in Texas, it's not like Texans go around saying, oh, we're the best. We're unlike those stupid Californians. We allow our housing sector to go and flourish. We don't go and strangle regulation. That's why we enjoy good cheap housing. Instead, they just take it for granted. So that's sort of the partisan breakdown. It is true that both parties are likely to favor regulation in general, but the areas of lightest regulation are generally Republican areas. The areas where they're reducing regulation are usually Democratic areas, but they're reducing it to something that is nowhere near how good it is in the lowest regulation areas, which are places like Texas.
Well, I'm reminded of I believe it was Scott Horton that oftentimes talk about that if you're talking to a left wing audience, you know, attack them from the left. If you're talking to a right wing audience, attack them from the right. And you actually do that fantastically well in the book as well. So let's say I'm waving a magic wand and you're now giving a talk in front of a overwhelmingly progressive audience and left wing politicians. How are you selling that audience on deregulation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I start off with, you know, you've got to buy the story about lower prices. If you don't buy that, then nothing else works. But assuming that I've got them on board for that, then say, well, first of all, this is a great way to go and make the average American better off. It reduces the cost of living for the average American, raises their standard of living. And it's especially good for people of lower income because lower income people spend a larger share of their income on housing. Housing's a necessity. The whole idea of a necessity is that the richer you are, the less of your income, the less of an income share you're spending on it. So we can get inequality down by deregulation. We can get social mobility up. A lot of the reason why people don't move to high wage areas right now is because the extra housing cost eats up the whole wage gain. Twas not always so. In the 1950s and 60s, people all over the U.S. moved to California where they could get higher pay, better weather, and without having to pay a lot extra for housing. Now, if you want to move to a nice part of the country, you've got to pay through the nose because it's been so hard for industry to go and build housing, keep up with rising demand. Let's see. Talk about the environmental benefits. So this is one where economists Ed Glaser and Matt Kahn have just gone through the math of carbon emissions, and here's what the arithmetic says. First of all, the best places in the world to go or best places in the country for people to build housing is in California because it's got great weather. Great sure. weather means that you're not using much in the way of heating or air conditioning, which means that you have a smaller carbon footprint. What does California actually do? Strictly regulate housing so people leave the state and live someplace else where they're going to go and pollute more. It's a crazy thing to do. It's like, I don't want the planet harmed here. It's like, well, then it's going to be harmed more elsewhere. So it'd be better to go and let people build freely in California. They also make the point that cities are greener than suburbs, and also new developments are greener than old ones, because even though new developments are bigger, the insulation and the materials are so much better that, again, the carbon footprint is lower. So that's another reason to go and support it. So, you know, put all that together, and I think there is a very good case from a reasonable left-wing point of view to say, yeah, this is something where, even if you don't trust markets generally, it totally makes sense to do it here. Of course, if I were talking to the left-wing audience, then I have to immediately say, okay, well, what about all the other things you could do instead? Because a key part of most left-wing audiences is that they're going to turn to markets as a last resort, not as a first resort. So that's where I've got to go over what's wrong with rent control, what's wrong with inclusionary zoning, what's wrong with government housing projects. These are all ideas that, probably the best thing for me to say is, well, like, very few economists who share your political views think those are good ideas. And then if you got more time and patience, we can talk about it. But, you know, it's a pretty simple idea. Just, you know, let people that supply the basic necessity of housing do their job so that it's available in abundance and therefore cheap.
Well, just for the sake of fairness, I know that it might be true that on net the right wingers are a little bit more open to deregulation as a general concept. But say exact same scenario, but you're talking to a right wing audience, because as you already pointed out, even if it is better in a Republican controlled state, it's not exactly laissez faire. So what's the argument for the right side?
Yeah. So, I mean, you start off saying, look, we got a pile of ridiculous government regulations strangling this wonderful industry. Like, don't you want people to be able to afford nice big homes? Well, free market will give it to you. But some of the other things that I say, look, there has been a big concern, especially among national conservatives, about the decline of good jobs for non-college males. My dissertation advisor, Ann Case and Angus Deaton, wrote this book, Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, or you might just know Cyrus Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. Right. So all of this comes down to, there's this demographic of non-college males that have not been doing well in recent years. A big part of the story is that the economy has changed a lot, and now basically they've either got to, if they want to get a job, they either got to go and go to college and learn to code, which a lot don't want to do, or they're sort of stuck doing unmanly service sector type jobs, which they also don't want to do. This has led a lot of national conservatives to say we need to go and use tariffs and other protectionist measures to revive manufacturing, so once again, non-college males can get traditional male employment. I have a piece called Revive Construction, Not the Rust Belt, where I just say, look, even in the best case scenario, this is barely going to make a dent, because there just isn't that much additional demand for traditional manufactured goods. We're satiated. You know, like, imagine someone came to your door, Alan, and said, hey, here's 5 new TVs, but you can't resell them. It's like, what would you say? Probably it's like, well, maybe 1 or 2, but I don't need 5 new TVs. Like, I just don't have any place for them. I don't have any use for them. On the other end, if someone said, hey, I've got a house, doesn't cost any more than a current one, twice the living space, it's a mile away. This is something where almost everybody is interested in that deal, right? So I say, instead of trying to go and revive manufacturing by going and strangling consumers' options to go and shop in the world market, it makes a lot more sense to deregulate housing, because almost everybody's interested in getting a better place to live. Whereas people are now pretty satisfied with their manufactured goods. We've just gotten so productive at making them that there isn't that much more of a desire to go and expand how many people are going to buy, but there's a lot of room to expand the size of the housing sector, right? You know, I mean, and even if you love your house, well, how about a second house? Why not? And so this is another thing. I think we've got a really good remedy for the problems that national conservatives have been talking about. Protectionism is not a good route. Deregulation of housing makes way more sense, right? And obviously a lot of those construction workers can wind up living in the very homes that they make. So that's nice too. I also talk about the effect of deregulation on fertility. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of skepticism of this, but I think it's really pretty simple. First of all, one of the biggest reasons why people keep living with their parents is they can't afford their own place. Pretty obviously. And around the world, this is true. Secondly, as long as you're living with your parents, you're probably not going to get married. Also pretty obvious. Third of all, even if you do get married living with your parents, you're probably not going to want to have kids as long as you live with your parents. All right, so take all this and say, huh, seems like the easiest way to go and get fertility back up is to deregulate housing, to get prices down so that people move out of their parents' houses sooner. I'm not saying that this is the only reason why fertility rates are down. There's a lot of reasons, but it's a totally practical thing that we could do instead.
Well, to sort of kind of put a bow on this, it seems like one of the issues that you're combating is that the general public sometimes gets caught up in this really black and white, all or nothing mentality, right? Mm-hmm. So we either have to have the mountainous bureaucratic state exactly the way it exists, because if we didn't, all hell would break loose, or we have to deregulate entirely overnight and then all hell will break loose. Mm-hmm. But of course, as we know, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. So in chapter 6, you talk about keyhole policies. What's mm-hmm. a keyhole policy?
Yeah, keyhole policy is where you really listen to people that are worried about what'll happen if you deregulate, and you realize you're not going to change their minds about the problem. Then you try to come up with a creative way of handling the problem with little or no regulation. For example, right, if people are worried about, say, I don't want you building skyscrapers because it's going to go and block light. It's like, all right, how about instead of having years of public hearings, we just go and have a fee for building a building of a certain height and size, and then you pay that, and then you can move on, and that's the solution. Right, and this is something where for almost any complaint, you can think about what really is the complaint. I mean, like the easiest ones, of course, are let people build whatever they want and then raise the price of parking and driving during peak times so that we don't have traffic problems. That's definitely my favorite keyhole solution. It's one where we still have government owning the streets. They're still owning the roads. It's nothing crazy. It's just taking advantage of modern technology. It makes it super convenient to collect tolls to do it, right? And again, if there's any doubt, would people actually change their behavior in response to price? Well, let's see, you can just come and walk 5 minutes from my house where there's a bridge over a road where it's got 6 free lanes and 4 toll lanes. The 4 toll lanes never have congestion. Right? I'm not just going to say never, right? You know, because they raised the price so that there is not, so that if congestion was going to happen, it doesn't happen. On the other hand, in the free lanes, there's congestion all the time. It's really pretty clear. Sometimes I take people there and say, just look at the economics. Of course, there's no reason for there to be congestion. There's no reason why roads have to look like parking lots. It's just a matter of stubbornly refusing to go and charge a higher price during peak times, which obviously doesn't mean that nobody ever gets to use the road or the price is always high. It just means that you're going to need to go and adjust your time in response to the incentives, which is one of the great things about the use of prices, is that it gives people a reason to think about the effects of their behavior on other people.
I just want to make sure that we're nailing the point, because I've already heard you talk about this before, too, that you're not above the idea that there are potential other negative externalities that mm-hmm. you haven't thought of today, but you're more making the point that even if we had a groundswell of support for this movement right now to deregulate, it would still take we're not talking about weeks or months, we're talking about years or mm-hmm. decades, and so maybe we would be able to take the good with the bad and stay off the bat.
Yeah, I mean it's totally true that my powers of persuasion are nowhere near good enough to turn 100 years of U.S. housing policy around today or with one book. If you were to push me and say, yeah, but what if, Brian? What if? Yeah, my honest view is that we should just rip up the laws right here, right now, go as far as we can. And then, like, won't there be some problems? Yeah, there'll be some problems, but the problems we'll cause will be a lot worse than the problems we got. So it's better just to go full speed ahead and then let the free market take care of it as best it can. I'm also very eager to say, yes, there are negative things about construction. There's also positive things. What gets discussed in all of the town planning meetings is only the negatives. Almost no one ever even brings up the positives. If you calm down, step back, you'll see, wow, there's a lot of positives to construction. And though you may be worried about what will happen if they go and build this new thing, you should be also thinking, oh, well, what good could happen? And the honest answer is, yeah, a lot of good stuff can happen and has happened in the past and will happen in the future.
It's so interesting. I can't help but think of times in the past taking that same kind of logic and applying it to politics. There's a lot of voters out there that when given the choice between, you know, an established incumbent who's been voting against their best interests, against their constituency for 40 years, and yet they get reelected time and time again. But if you go to that voter and say, well, do you want to reelect that same incumbent who you've been dissatisfied with for 40 years, or do you want to elect this new person who you perhaps haven't heard as much about? They're a little bit out of left field. They have a lot of ideas that you're happy with. Oh, but they find one thing they disagree with. But finding one thing they disagree with a new challenger is enough to disqualify them, as opposed to the 40 years of things they disagree with the incumbent.
Yeah, I mean, this makes a lot of sense, especially for primaries. I don't think your story really fits in the general election, but in primaries, definitely, where there's some, you know, most notably among Republican voters, there are a lot of longstanding Republican politicians that have just allowed universities to become left-wing cathedrals, done nothing about it. And yet, if there's some new person who comes along and says, hey, you've just sat on your hands for 40 years, this has gotten really bad, they'll say, well, you know, what do you want? What do you want? Like, you know, just yeah, I want someone to go and note that we have basically established a left-wing religion on public university campuses, and something ought to be done about it.
Well, on that note, I'll give you the last word. Is there anything that we've missed or something that you want to make sure to highlight in this book?
Let's see.
I tried to be thorough.
It was very thorough. Yeah, I mean, here's actually the main thing that we didn't talk about. One of the main reasons why I wrote this as a graphic novel is because I realized that a lot of the objections to housing deregulation are aesthetic. It's going to be ugly. I don't want to look at that. That's going to look bad. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote this chapter, Bastiat's Buildings, where I try to actually go and show people what they could have but don't. Because as long as you're just imagining the future, it's very human to just go and picture worst-case scenarios. So I said, what if I just draw pictures about a beautiful alternate world, which again, you might say, well, that doesn't really prove anything. I think actually it's a better argument than you might think. I mean, for example, it's totally standard to say you can't develop coastline at all. And yet the most beautiful coastlines in the world are the developed coastlines. And if you go to the Amalfi Coast of Italy, what makes it beautiful is the blending of architecture and nature. The nature by itself is nice, but it's not stunning. But combine it with human development and you make it better, not worse. And obviously, when you're going and developing the coastline, the goal is not to uglify it. Right. So that a lot of what I try to do there is just to persuade people that the new world won't just be cheap and abundant, but it's also going to be gorgeous.
Well, you've heard it here first, folks. Developers are not going out of their way to make ugly properties for people to purchase. Bryant, where can people go to pick up the book?
Yeah, so I think it's going to be everywhere books are sold. I normally do Amazon, so that's where I would start. But wherever you want to start, it's good in my book, as long as you buy the book. And by the way, one other thing. Though I am a professor, this is a book that even kids like. I do try to write it at the intellectual level where active researchers will say that it's accurate and fair and well-informed. But at the same time, I also try to make it so entertaining that even little kids steal their parents' books. So if you're on the edge, this is something you can read to your kids. It's not just something to read for yourself.
Well, I want to end with a compliment to you, because I think you did a good job with that in the book. And in the same, of course, my favorite, The Case Against Education, you have the same sort of writing style there as you had here, as you have in Open Borders, which is even if the audience who is, you know, picking up the information, even if they can't remember every single statistic, you know, they're not taking every single footnote. I mean, there you go. Yeah, but you're just pounding people with point after point after point after point. You're not wasting a bunch of time and space to get to it. It's, oh, you know, you don't believe in the, you know, or sheepskin versus, you know, educational malpractice of secondary schools. Well, here in this one, I'm going to indulge myself. I'm going to waste another minute of the show. There's a particular part of the book where you talk about, like, look, I'm not saying that, you know, regular people are all just a bunch of idiots. I can even control for biologists and engineers and see that, well, actually outside of their fields of expertise, big surprise, they're not exactly experts in all these other fields. That doesn't make anyone smart or stupid. That makes them a human being. That's normal. So I think you do a fantastic job of taking on a subject and just it's just page after page after page of point. To the point where I would say, if we lived in a saner world where people were more open-minded, they would look at that and at a bare minimum would say, well, this is going to challenge perhaps my preconceived notions. I think the only people who wouldn't be challenged by the book are the people who, frankly, they're not going to buy it, right? They're not going to buy this book because they're not looking to be challenged.
Yeah. So, like, I'd say, like, you know, people that talk to me every day, they might say, okay, I kind of expected this. But yeah, I do try to surprise people. I try to look at it from a lot of different angles. And I'll just say, I love good arguments. I just love an argument. I just love trying to come up with a different way of looking at something that actually gets you from where you are to where you could be. Right? And, you know, just saying, look, do you believe that if you're running a lemonade stand, you'd cut the price to sell more? I mean, that's just something I came up with on the fly pretty much. But I think it's something you'd have to be pretty dogmatic just to say, no, you're making that up. It's common sense. That really is what I try to always come back to. Even though a big part of the book is trying to boil down academic research and distill it, same time, like, I also want people to consider, well, what have you seen with your own eyes? Does this act, you know, like, you know, not what you're supposed to believe, but what have you really seen? That's what I'm trying to do in Build Baby Build.
Well, Dr. Kaplan, it's criminal that it's been a few years since I had you on the show before. When we were last together, you and I were debating how we would fix the end of Game of Thrones. And sure enough, 3 years later, not even George R. R. Martin himself has fixed the end of Game of Thrones. And so maybe the next time you come on, we'll be able to debate that.
All right. Yeah, that's a very popular piece, strangely. Another podcaster started off with housing, and somehow we got off onto the how to fix Game of Thrones tangent. So, yeah, I'm good to do that anytime you want, Alan.
Well, thank you so much. Guys, we're going to be back to wrap up the show right after this commercial break.
Don't go away.
If you're enjoying tonight's show, consider supporting the program by becoming a member of our Patreon. That's over at patreon.com/AlanMosley. Like our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/AlanMosleyTV. You can follow me on Twitter. Twitter.com/AlanMosleyTV. Subscribe to our YouTube page. It's youtube.com/AlanMosleyTV. But if you're more of a listener than a watcher, you can get us on your favorite podcasting platform of choice, thanks to Spotify. It's Too Late with Alan Mosley or Alan Mosley TV. Also, don't forget to get your tickets for the 6th annual It's Too Late live show, coming to you Saturday, May 18th in beautiful Columbia, Tennessee. Dave, do you have a final thought?
This Saturday. That's coming up.
That's this Saturday.
I'm gonna be standing in your house before you know it.
Yeah.
I'm going to be in there.
Yeah. Well, it's better than when you were laying in my house the last time.
Oh, well, I like a good nap.
Yeah, you had a long weekend. You needed, looked like you were tuckered out. So we all just kind of walked around you.
Yeah. It's my way of being antisocial.
That's all right. Well, I guess there's no after party because, the secret's out. This actually was pre-taped. So by the time people are seeing this, you're in Ohio. So it's
sleeping.
Yeah. Well, you better not be sleeping. You're driving. Yeah, it's Mary. What the fuck?
She had the weirdest dream.
Oh my god! Guys, thank you so much for watching another episode of It's Too Late, and we will see you next week
or this weekend.
Drive towards the light, Dave. Yeah. Well, yeah, we'll do the after party in a few days at Poncho's.
Yeah. Real life.
Yeah.
It'd be awesome.
But, you know, it's not too late for you to click on that event link and type in 999-99-99 and put in your Sears card and just see what happens. A bunch of the names right there on the screen are going to be there. They're going to be there.
If it goes through, we can give them some of their money back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're not going to do that. I mean.